Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network. This is actually a YouTube video that I had released out on my channel last week, but I want to release it to the feed here because it is so good. So I'm not going to talk too much about the speaker, Robert Aubrey Davis, because I talk a lot about him when I'm introducing him for the YouTube video. So I just wanted to put this in here so that you knew you were going to be listening to an interview, and there's a different introduction welcoming people to my channel and everything like that, which you're going to hear first, and then we're going to get into it with Robert Aubrey Davis, who is the host of the Millennium of Music program on Sirius XM and public radio stations, and we talk about Tudor music and how Thomas Tallis was just a really good guy and lots of other fun stuff. So enjoy and thanks for listening. Hey there, and welcome to the YouTube channel for the Renaissance English History Podcast. If you are new here, very special warm welcome to you. My name is Heather. I have been podcasting on Tudor England since 2009. This YouTube channel is where I put all my extra content, stuff that doesn't always make it onto the podcast, stuff that isn't always Tudor related, but always history related, book reviews, all kinds of fun stuff. So if you would like to have more history in your YouTube feed, why not go ahead and hit subscribe, and that way you'll never miss out on a video that I put out. So today I'm going to share an interview that I just did with Robert Aubrey Davis. And before I officially kind of give the spiel about who Robert Aubrey Davis is, I want to tell you who he is for me first, because he's a very special person to me. He hosts a radio show on Sirius XM called Millennium of Music. He also hosts Broken Beyond. There's a couple of different Sirius XM shows. If you ever listen to Symphony Hall on Sirius XM, you have heard him, I promise, because he's just kind of everywhere. But first, people often ask me how I got into Tudor history, and I've shared this before. If you've been around me long enough, you know that the way I got into Tudor history was through the music, through singing Ave Verum Corpus, a William Byrd piece in Chamber Singers, when I was in 11th grade. And I remember the choral director just said something offhand about how Byrd was a recusant Catholic. And I was like, what does that mean? It sounds rebellious. And, you know, I was 16 and I thought I was quite rebellious. And so I went to the library and I looked it up and, you know, I learned that it meant it was a Catholic who had to hide their faith during the reign of Elizabeth because she was a Protestant. And I started thinking about what it was like for Byrd, especially, to be writing music for a service that he didn't necessarily believe in, while at the same time writing these kind of sacred pieces for secret worship, because he wrote, you know, these Latin masses that were to be sung in private homes. And something about that just really, really struck me. And that's how I got into this period of history. And so my relationship with this period has always been through the music of Tudor England. And so I have a very special relationship, you know, with the music, and that's how my relationship has gone with it. He is, like I said, he produces and hosts Millennium of Music, heard on public radio stations, also Sirius XM. He also produces specials, including On Holiday, a series of 5 one-hour programs that explore the music and culture of different European nations. He is a frequent lecturer and commentator for arts institutions throughout Washington, D.C. He hosts weekly arts discussion program around town for WETA in the nation's capital. He is also a contributing writer to newspapers, journals, cultural publications, both nationally and internationally. After working in public radio for over 20 years, he became the program director for two channels on XM satellite radio, Vox, which was dedicated to vocal classical music from Gregorian chant through to opera, and The Village, modeled after the public radio program Songs for Aging Children. It was a celebration of 60s folk music that Davis hosted for nearly 15 years. The Village is a unique gathering of singer-songwriters across generations. So that is who Robert Aubrey Davis is in the world. You should go to his website, Millennium of Music. Say that 10 times fast. Millenniumofmusic.com. Like I said, there's tons of free stuff on there. You don't have to subscribe, but you also can subscribe. It's very reasonable to get like the full archives of everything. He's fantastic. I could listen to him talk forever and ever and ever. Somebody should just make like a recording of just him talking about all of this stuff. He's so brilliant. He has said that he will come back and do another podcast with me. Hopefully it won't take 8 years. So if you would like to have him come back, please leave a comment and let me know whether you have like questions for him, what you would like for him to talk about. If you enjoyed this interview, I would love some feedback so I can take it back to him and say, hey, people enjoyed this and they want us to talk about this, this, this next time, or listen to you talk about this, this, this. So thank you to Robert Aubrey Davis for coming, and please check out his website. And now we're just going to jump right into him. All right, here we go. I'm so excited. Oh my gosh, it's been like 8 years that I didn't know if you were real or not. And here you are.
I'm not really real. This is part of the chat GPI version of me.
Yeah. Okay. So you're like actually a hologram.
I am indeed. Like, yes. Yeah.
The AI version of you.
It took all the money in the world to create this hologram, but you know, it was worth it apparently. Okay. So
You did it just for me, huh?
I totally, and I also voice your ways, directions when you drive around town. I could do any of that. That's how it is.
Wow. We got to plug that at the end. Okay. Yeah. So let's just start the big question. How did the musical changes of the 16th century reflect the cultural changes? There was a lot going on, religious turmoil, printing presses, lots of the Reformation, the Renaissance, and in England, the religious whiplash. So just looking at England, starting at, say, 1485, if we want to start at the beginning of the Tudor period to 1603, like, how did the musical changes reflect what was going on in society, would you say?
Well, you know, it's funny how art is, and it's funny how we characterize these things. We tend to go by these arbitrary periods that we assign, mostly for later on's benefit, never for the time itself. And if you sort of think, you see this Tudor period very much from the various machinations that occur geopolitically. But there's also an argument that much of art comes out of a more stable, rooted, ongoing evolution or just process of, you know, the living day-to-day of the universe. I mean, there's a wonderful meditation that you could have lived in England your entire life of the Hundred Years' War and never seen a single battle or heard of one. And it is very specific how the impact on people, on the citizenry, is based on these various changes and what happens. And England is a unique event. I mean, it is different from anything else. Great Britain, because, you know, this sceptered isle, this emerald jewel, this place that is uniquely separate from the continent, evolved musically differently, and it evolved spiritually differently. And I think, just like we tend to arbitrate, I mean, it's weird when you see there's a different period for, say, painting than there is for poetry, than there is for music. In the subsequent academic worlds, that's not the way the real world works. All these people talk to one another. All these people know one another. And the idea that we can separate out what occurs, you know, musically as an evolution from not just the geopolitical, but what England is, what the nature of this, you know, this amazing land and how it evolved was. And I think there are arguments to be made that it is much more, you know, there's sort of like you could sort of skip the continental world because the way music evolves in, say, Italy or France is very different from the Holy Roman Empire and England, in which you have a sort of rooted and very possibly more earthy and very often more isolated creative pocket type of world. So before we even get to the time of the Tudors, you have a few patterns that evolve. You have a musical evolution that's different from the continent. And you know, there's a very famous French ambassador who wrote what he called the Douceur Angevin. And it was an idea that English music was sweeter. There was a sweetness to it. It used different intervals. You know, all of music that we sort of think of as Western is based on the Louis-Louis chord progression. Da-na-na, da-na, da-na-na, da-na. So it's 1-4-5. And England used a lot of thirds and sixes. And you have that most unusual quality to it. Part two is that the way England has always been fascinated by Italy. And historically, the relationship artistically and musically is profound. And this goes back, and this is very important for what evolves in Tudor music, to both the Franciscans, the idea of, Francis's idea that we need to make music more accessible and more of the people. And he took sacred works that were in Latin and made them into the vernacular. And that idea gets to both the Franciscan and Augustinian monasteries that dot all of Great Britain. And from thence, we get the evolution of what had been a dance form, what had been a dance form that would have been very much what we think of as pagan, the carol form. And we have this round dance that eventually we have carols for all kinds of things, springtime carols and the like. But when it gets to be for Christmas, we can actually pick specific Augustinian and Franciscan monasteries where specific carols come out.
Really?
And these specific tunes, some of which we still sing. When the Shearsman, beautiful song that we still sing at Christmas time from that particular mystery play, and on and on and on. These things become part of a web of musical life that every composer is born into. It is fortunate that when the Tudors evolve with, Henry VII, we have one great figure who arises. And this is kind of like the great, person theory of history. We already had one extraordinary composer, John Dunstable. And he was there for the earlier Henrys and the miserable Richard and on and on and on. And by the way, Richard III is not a good person. So don't listen to all the rhetoric about it. He's just not there, Sorry. The musical scene, when it wasn't encouraged in court, would then go to specific centers like John of Gaunt or whatever, would have been a very good example of someone who preserved music and funded musicians for specific reasons. And so you have this body of composers that begin to come about with the one titanic example of being John Taverner. Taverner is the really overarching figure. And while he was, he received commissions, but his music was respected, and it was respected in a way, and, this dynamic tension between what happens of course, it already happened in the rest of Europe, but what was going on then with England under Henry and the abandonment of Catholicism. But Taverner, the important thing to remember is that when any composer, and when I say any composer, I mean every composer you can name in the Tudor era, wrote variations on a theme called In Nomine. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a section of a mass, right? It's in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. And the particular tune comes from Taverner's mass, the Gloria Tibi Trinitas, which is a specific Catholic doctrine piece. And every single one of those Reformation composers who set that piece knew exactly where it came from and why. So while we are leaving behind, in many cases, you know, the idea that we can't be Catholic, that hum, that drumbeat never leaves. It never leaves under the subsequent mess that happens with the Jameses, of course, with Charles's, with the vast, you know, explosion, with the attempt to put the Stuarts on the throne, when the Hanoverians take over. And then, you know, the rebellion against the Hanoverians is genuinely kind of in the 19th century. And then you sort of see this return of Catholicism in England. And the weird statistic where apparently there are more Catholics in England than Protestants today. So this is this bizarre dynamic. It never changes. It never goes away. For all the countervailing murders and killings and Bloody Mary rhetoric and all that stuff, there's a huge body of work, by the way. This came to me, this is specifically through music and no other place, of defense of Mary Tudor and how she was not only a far more enlightened monarch than many people give her credit for, but that her reign was much longer, of course, than people genuinely know. They just sort of think of it, well, that was a bad bit, let's get rid of her. But the work she did with her artists, and if art is important to one, and if art is sort of the conveyance of this, and the composers she worked with and she supported, in the case of Thomas Tallis, of course, who lived on, it is an extraordinary thing to think about. You know, here she's put to death by her cousin, and then lo and behold, the cousin makes sure that Thomas Tallis is the most single honored person in the artistic court. That is to say, of all the arts. That is to say, of all the poets and everything else, Tallis was the person. And Tallis is the specific and direct inheritor of John Taverner. Mm. Note for note, you know, treated him as a master. And the way that William Byrd, who's, you know, we're very happily celebrating this year because the 40th anniversary is dead, you know. And that is to say, everyone, including, I just got a note there from Graham Ross at Clare College, and every single, you know, person who does recording and is working today is doing a William Byrd. The King Singers have a new one out, on and on and on. It's kind of fun. Yeah. But it's also importantly good because it reminds everybody, I think if you dig into what happens with Tallis and Byrd, you have as good a window into the Tudor era as any single thing you can put your finger on. There is no better way, with the very possible exception of theater and its evolution in this time and what happens to it, to really understand this era than with these two characters.
Now, so for somebody who doesn't know Tallis and Byrd and doesn't know when you understand what's happening between them, like I don't know that much either about their person. I know Byrd, they say, was a recusant Catholic and wrote these masses in Latin. And Thomas Tallis, I've heard him referred to as Teflon Tallis because he made it through all the different monarchs unscathed. And they had a publishing business, right? The queen gave them the rights to publish. Like, tell me what was going on.
So Tallis, the most important thing to know about Thomas Tallis is that, and there are very few people in the history of art that are this. He was a lovely human being. This doesn't exist. And, you know, there's a famous vid cover study back in the 50s, Born Under Saturn, where they take every single artist who's ever lived and they show how cuckoo crazy they all are.
Yeah.
But what is his tombstone there in Greenwich says, here lies Thomas Tallis, who died as he had lived, of meek and gentle sort. Oh, lucky man. And it is just an extraordinary thing to think about this. There wasn't a single negative piece of press, wasn't a single negative comment, there's not a single dot that says anything negative about Thomas Tallis, who was literally a practicing Catholic his entire life. So with the various machinations that occur geopolitically, he didn't just publish music. He had, from the Queen, this is Elizabeth, gave him the rights for the exclusive publishing of anything in England that was musical. That is to say, if you wanted anything in print, you had to go through this guy. Now, the history of publishing in of all types, but particularly music, is fascinating and gives you a tremendous window into art and commerce and everything else you can imagine.
But was it your palace, or was, because I had read that he was partners with Bird for a while. Did they have something together jointly, or no?
Now, remember, Tallis, who's about 1500, 1585.
Right. Bird was his student.
His pupil and a beloved pupil. And on Tallis' death, Bird wrote one of the most beautiful laments in the history of music. And every single person who met Bird either wrote or said something about him that was one of these tributes. And it wasn't a pro forma tribute like after Louis XIV died, we all had to write something. Or indeed, after Elizabeth herself died and everybody wrote something. And these pieces are extraordinary, because everybody realized that this will never come again. Artists are smarter than one might imagine. And when you see Tompkins writing a sad pavan for these distracted times after Elizabeth's death, you know he knew, all these people knew, that this can't happen again. You can't have this. This will never be. Shakespeare getting out of the game. I mean, you know, he muddled on and wrote some extraordinary and powerful and terrible things, terrible in the original sense, like Macbeth. But it is literally the end. I mean, it's the end of the world as we know it, with the death of Elizabeth. And everything changed after that. You know, there are moments and rebirths and the this and the that. But when people say that, you know, they call British music the 20th century English Renaissance, because, you know, there is Henry Purcell and there are some people here and there dipping and dopping, and but really and truly it's the end of the 19th century before we really get the Renaissance of music from the time of Elizabeth. So Tallis's wisdom, his grace, his gentility, his humility, the exquisite nature of his writing, his music is incomparably beautiful. I mean, truly incomparably beautiful. There's not a single chorister in these, you know, when you sing in English choruses, and tens of thousands of people do and have been trained. You come to the Lamentations of Jeremiah of Thomas Tallis, and everybody likes it. Everybody wants to sing it. Everybody wants to do that piece. So this exclusive publishing experience continues through Henry and what happens after Henry's death and into Elizabeth and substantially into the, you know, 1585 is pretty far along in the game. So William Byrd comes along. Now, Byrd is a different figure. He is not a Tallis-like guy. He is, there are the sort of the famous, there's two kinds of geniuses. There's the Wagner type who can do the one thing, and then there is the Brahms type who can do anything. And so, you know, the universalist piece is Byrd. And he could write in any form, wrote lots of chamber music, a lot of keyboard stuff that's still performed today all the time. Wrote consort pieces, wrote secular and very witty, very hilarious, sometimes bawdy songs. But he had, as part of the ongoing process throughout all of the Christianized world, when there was the Reformation, there were still practicing Catholics that had to hide themselves away. And when you go to the, if you do the stately home tour of England or whatever, and you see the priest holes and all these little corners where this is kept, you would have these places where you could do sacred services in the Catholic tradition. And what Burr did is he had a body of pieces, exquisite writings that were for the entire church year, as well as the three famous and glorious masses. And I remember one time Peter Phillips of the Talus Scholars did a thing for me where he said, you know, we the best way to compare and contrast this is to hear the credo from the Mass for Three Voices. And about the same time, he wrote a version, you know, I believe idea for Elizabeth for the Anglican service. And he said, listen to these two and hear the difference between a private and interior spiritual meditation and a public expression, and see the difference. You can actually hear the difference in how these two things can compare and contrast. And he kind of paints this for you, and you can really hear it in Bird's writing. Now, Bird, of course, you know, as we celebrate this 400th anniversary, anybody can hear him and enjoy him, and there's no need for a window in. There's no special, I'm hearing something unique and profound because, you know, there are tunes that we still whistle and hum, and, oh, you know, there's a band setting, Gordon Jacobs had a hilarious band setting of a bunch of Bird tunes and on and on and on. So there's that. And then there's all, you know, Glenn Gould did a Bird recording for piano and on that stuff. So there's all of that stuff. But to do Thomas Tallis, you're doing a very specific and a very different.
Gotcha.
That's a different. Yeah. Yeah. But publishing is hugely important. I mean, this is not a joke. I mean, this is not just a filter. It was also, if you ever worked with an editor?
Yeah,
then you know what it's like working with an editor. So it's like that too. But Bird had buddies, and you know, many of these buddies, some of them were, you know, the poets were often killed if you were Catholic. The musicians kind of survived if you were Catholic, you know. But if you were like Dowlin, you're trying to get a gig at Elizabeth for reasons nobody knows, didn't think this brilliant, you know, deeply weird guy would be the person for her. And so he converts, and you know, then he goes to freaking Denmark and gets jobs, and eventually comes back. And when he finally gets hired by James, quits writing music.
Right.
Lives on.
Why do you think that the Catholic tradition stayed for so long in England, and that it developed differently than, say, I guess I wonder, because the Reformation in England was so different than in Europe. Obviously, everything's a unique thing, but how Henry never really wanted to become a Protestant. He just didn't really want to have a boss. And then all of this whiplash with Edward and the stripping of the altars, and then Mary and back, and then Elizabeth and the settlement. Like, what do you think out of that made it so that some of these traditions that were so, that if you knew that they were Catholic, that people could continue writing like that without being punished? How did that come about?
Well, I think there's two things. First, I think we can never overstate the remarkable choices Elizabeth made. I think, you know, in terms of the great woman theory of history, you know, yes, there were mistakes, and yes, there were oddities, and yes, there were this and that, and yes, she did some bad things. But you have to remember that she is against a titanic force. And, you know, the titanic force is not just, you know, Philip II and what's going on in Spain and the probability of invasion. And, you know, when Mary Queen of Scots was alive, and, you know, there were Italians everywhere for the very specific reason that, like I say, the English have this enormous affection for the Italians, and all of them brought Italians into the court. Now, to his credit, musically, especially working with both William Cornish the Elder and William Cornish the Younger, the Elder worked for Henry VII and taught the young Henry VIII. Henry VIII was a very good musician and a composer of a very high order, and was a very artistic young man. And yet, he, when he becomes a monarch, fell in love. Now, yes, Erasmus had a lot to do with that. But the whole, you know, the whole Flemish universe suddenly comes into court. And there's these hilarious songs. I mean, Worried About Jolly Rutterkin by Cornish, which is a very popular tune, later set by Ray Vaughan Williams. Well, this is the Dutch who, before the Dutch came in, the British could not brew beer. They only made ale. And it was under the Flemish that they came in and showed these freaking English people how to actually make decent beer. That's a true story. And I care about this. This is a topic I'm deep in. Forget about music. We can talk about beer at night. That's a different podcast, but never mind. So, but it was even then we start getting these Italian families, and Elizabeth, even though she's surrounded by Catholic enemies trying to overthrow her, brings in this huge collection. Not, you see names like Thomas Lupo and all the Cooperario. He changed his name to be more like an Italian. He's John Cooper, because Giovanni Cooperario, because everybody was Italian who was cool. The cool kids were Italians. Tallis would never have written his 40 voice motet if Strigio hadn't come there with an Italian choir and done a 40 voice piece.
It like bet or something that they said he couldn't do one the same after having heard that Italian one?
Well, I don't know to what extent he saw it as a challenge as much as an inspiration. And I think it was a specific inspiration that followed. And of course, Strigio's actual original, which has been beautifully, very recently recorded, it'll be on Millennium coming up, one movement on it. And this is not 40 voices, like there's 40 singers. These are 40 individualized voice parts, each of which is different. One movement of that mass is for 80 voices. To show he could.
Yeah.
To show it's possible. So what Tallis does with the Spemenolium is take this. Now, it's not something, it's a little like how many horsepower can a car really have? Mm-hmm. It can only have so much, and it really doesn't work well anymore. And it's a little like that with voices, too. That's why there are no 199 voice motets or anything. You know, it just, you know. However, when a great genius can tackle something like that and turn it into something, I mean, I'll put like that Spemenolium by Tallis is better than the Strigio Mass. It's just better. It's a better piece of music, you know. And although the Strigio is incomparable and extraordinary, but, you know, he's actually, Strigio, by the way, is way more fun as a composer, by the way, of madrigals that were hilarious, that a lot of the Brits loved. I mean, Morley, Thomas Morley and Wilkes and these guys thought this was hilarious. And the King Singers very famously do one of the Strigio pieces that was done for Queen Elizabeth that involves a card game where they actually play cards on the stage to show how the game works.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. So that kind of stuff. And the Italians give, because the Italians are, you know, banging on the door of what's to come music. They are banging on the door of what we think of as what we horribly call Baroque music, which is a nonsense term. But these consorts and this musical scene, this liveliness, this inventiveness, this stuff, which they keep bringing in, even though you're just like, you know, sleeping with the enemy, if you're Elizabeth, you're bringing in these people from these, you might know she didn't bring in tons of Spanish composers.
Right.
And with the recent unpleasantness between England and France, we don't have much French connection, but the Italians, oh yeah, love these Italians. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's so kind of fun.
I could listen to you talk all day.
And I will. And I'll come back.
Okay. I want to be mindful of your time. So here's my question to you.
I have infinite I'm never going anywhere.
You're not. Well, and you're a hologram too, so I can just
that's
tap in.
That's true. Exactly right. Yeah.
So if someone is new to learning about this kind of music or listening to this kind of music, where do you suggest they start? And I would posit that part of that would be listening to Millennium of Music. And where can they do that?
Well, that's very sweet. I mean, millenniummusic.com, just go online. And we have hundreds of free programs you can hear. And we've done, you know, many, many, many hundreds on English music of all different stripes. But I would also say, like Kenneth Clark says, it's the golden thread. Find the one thing that seems to be moderately interesting to you personally. And that could be everything for what are these weird instruments or what is this idea of, I mean, that we all think sitting down and playing our guitar and singing is a great thing to do. What are the roots of that? And where does that come from and why? And why are some of these English composers so important in the evolution of, I mean, there is an entire body of music that evolves in France under Louis XIII that we can say kind of comes out of people like Dowland and this idea of sitting down with a lute and singing along. These tunes are fantastic. This is why Sting did an album of nothing but John Dowland. And to interview Sting, his people made a list of every single person who'd ever done a Dowland album and asked how many of those people I can say I knew or have interviewed. And I uniquely had interviewed every single one of them, except for Alfred Deller, who I did know, but of course it was before Millennium of Music began. So that was kind of cool. So Sting was stuck with me. Trying to make sure that album became the best-selling early music album of all time. It became number two after the recording Chant. But that's a different thing. But in the meantime, everybody gets fascinated by something. And you don't have to learn anything. It's the great thing about music. It's the ambient sound. And the other thing about English music, it can be bawdy and hilarious. It can be descriptive. There's an entire recording of nothing but Settings of the Cries of London from this time, which is extraordinary. And some of these are fairly short and some of these are very long, but it's when you walk through the streets or you hear Shakespeare or go to a play and you see these street criers calling out what's happening. This is all set to music. And there are recordings of that, and there's the most beautiful and profound sacred pieces. I mean, there's a universe there, just like there's a universe and everything we're doing. I mean, there's this new movie about Catherine Parr is taking Cannes Film Festival by storm because people never tire of what you do, Heather, just like they never tire of you.
And I will never tire of you. So sure. I am so grateful to have had the chance to talk with you. It only took us 8 years to get this going. So it won't take us 8 years to do another one.
Well, I'm sort of looking forward to 2031 when we get back together. Wait for that. But what I could say is your titanic audience, they're so titanic, the iceberg lettuce, as I say. But yes, your titanic audience should write questions to you. And then next time I see you, you say, well, you know, Lurleen in Teaneck, New Jersey wants to know this. And then we will answer that question.
We'll do like a little Q&A with Robert Aubrey Davis.
Yeah.
And people should go to Millennium of Music and get a subscription and learn more as well
too. Well, there's a bunch of stuff for free, and you know, it's clearly the labor of love, this stupid show, because as opposed to you who've gotten rich beyond the dreams of Croesus doing all of your work with the Tudor England and all of that, in this case it's for people to have a place to go and it has been a great haven. That's the one thing about all of this. It's a great haven as well, you know.
You're smart and you have a sense of humor. Just perfect.
It's all to entertain you. If I'm not entertaining you, my work here is just beginning until I get better. I need to be better. My philosophy is it's all about entertaining Heather. And if I do that, my work here is done.
That's I am the center of the universe, so.
Well, in my mind, you certainly are. I assume everybody else needs to be like that, you know. We'll get there. Absolutely.
All right. thank you for your time. I'm going to edit this and I'm going to get it put up, and I will let you know what the questions are and the response. And hopefully you'll get a lot of hits on your website then.
Oh, my greatest hit is being with you. And don't edit this stuff out. This is the fun stuff. This is the stuff people really want to see.
No,
they don't want to see bloviation about, you know, music and in the time of Henry VII. They want to hear the fun stuff, you know?
I have noticed that I get the most comments on my YouTube videos when I talk about the most random unrelated stuff that's not at all related to history. So I will leave this in. But will you come back again sometime before?
I'm hoping tomorrow.
Okay, great.
That's what I want, you know, that's how it goes, you know?
All right. We'll see how that goes. I will let you know. Thank you. I appreciate you so much. You're wonderful.
Happy birthday.
Oh, well, that was a little.
It was a little while. I know, but we keep trying.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Call me anytime. I'm there.
Okay.
We'll see you.
See you. Bye.